Sometimes when you're driving, you come across a corner or a shift in the road, and there's a little cross there. Maybe a couple of faded flowers. And the cross just says one thing, doesn't it? It says somebody died here. Someone's life cut short in one of those everyday, banal tragedies. One minute driving along the road, going to work or going out for a meal or coming home from a party. Few brief seconds of chaos and screaming, and then that's it. You're dead. Everything that you've done in this life, it's all over. Everything you've left undone, you'll never get a chance to finish it. I wonder what happens to the people who die that way. Often when people die suddenly, unprepared, maybe in shock, confusion, don't know where you are. So it's quite likely that they maybe hang around as a ghost or a spirit or something. Imagine how lonely that must be. Not even a ghost haunting a house. At least if you're a ghost in a house, you've got people to annoy. You can rattle the windows and throw the dishes off the table and so on to get people right scared. What can you do if you're a ghost on the wayside, just watching cars come and cars go? Just a little cross with a couple of flowers and soon disintegrate, fade away, get blown away. And then that's it, you're just a stark reminder of mortality. And just waiting. Waiting there, not for any reason. Not because you want to get something. It's not like you're waiting in line, you know, to go in to see a movie or you know, you're waiting to get on an airplane, or you've actually got something that you want to do, something to look forward to. You're just waiting because you haven't got anywhere else to go. There's no walls keeping you there, there's no chains tying you down. But there's just nowhere to go, so you stay there. The samsara is full of these kinds of possibilities. It's full of these little nooks and crannies, these dead ends, these byways. Sometimes they may be in the human realm. We can get stuck into our life, get caught in a rut, caught somewhere. And we can be in very much the same kind of situation, can't we, even though we're here living a human life. But we can still feel very much like that, can't we? We can feel that we just ended up here because of some random event that plucked us out of one place, planted us in another. Here we are. Maybe there's some rhyme and reason to it. Maybe there's some karma or something that will help us to understand it, give some meaning to it, but we don't know what that is. So as far as we can tell, we're just here at random. And then we just cope, don't we? We just stay because we haven't got anywhere else to go. You get up in the morning, you make breakfast because that's what you do. You go to work because that's what you do. You walk down the street and there's another 100 or another 1,000 people walking down the street. And if you weren't there on that street walking down there, no one would notice. And so very often we live our lives just like this, just like a hungry ghost. We're just moving, restless, following our craving, following our hunger, our thirst, but without really any understanding of what it is that we're doing, why it is that we're here. Why am I following this routine? Why do I do this? Why do I want these things? Why do I wear these clothes? Why? What's the point? Samsara is designed to hide these things from us. Sometimes we end up in a place that we think is much better. We end up maybe in the heaven realm. We have all the things that we want, beautiful clothes and beautiful people around us and lots of food and sex and music and all of the things to keep us amused. That's how people like to imagine heaven. It's kind of a big rave party or something like that. Of course, the problem with heaven is that as soon as you start to really think about it, it starts to get even more horrifying, doesn't it? It starts to get a bloody horrible idea. You're stuck somewhere where you're just, you know, just nothing but that light and beauty, and everything around you is always sweet and saccharine, and everybody looks beautiful, and nothing has any meaning anymore. It's always the gritty in things that give it meaning. And so this is what that idea of heaven really is, just a kind of a projection of life with all the downside, the dark side taken away from it. So it ends up being a very impoverished, very flat kind of existence. How long can you live like that before getting bored? We know this. This is very common. Even in the human realm, we see this all the time. People who have endless money and so on. For most people, it doesn't last very long. You know, you can kind of enjoy the yachts and the drugs and stuff, but it doesn't. Only lasts for a few years and you get sick of it. People, for example, people who win big lottery payouts, for example, many of them end up saying this is the worst thing that's ever happened to them in their lives. Families fall apart. Their friends can't be just friends anymore. Everybody's wanting money. Everybody's after something. And so you can try to live like a god for, you know, if you do it for a weekend, you probably think it's great. If you do it for a week, you're probably going to get pretty burnt out. If you do it for a year or 10 years, you're likely to survive. You're lucky if you can survive. And so underneath this is just another kind of mindset, another kind of fever. And remember that the rich and the beautiful and the powerful, they don't have any more pure minds or more more developed minds than the rest of us. It's only the externals that's more developed. And so all of the the effort that goes into shaping these externals, the ridiculous amount that people spend on clothes and plastic surgery and all of these things, you know, shows the level of emptiness, the hole that's inside people, that need to keep on projecting a surface. Keep on projecting. Building up this world that will distract, entertain. It's like a glamour. A glory that shines and shows it like a shows gives a presence or a surface in the mind, but there's nothing behind it. And so ultimately, those beings who are living in those kind of deva realms, they're no more satisfied than the ghosts sort of staying by the roadside. In both cases, there's this hunger, kind of yearning for something, this need for something, but no understanding of what actually can be done to fulfill that need. Of course, these things are very relative. For many people in the world, our life here in Australia and here at Santi Monastery is like the deva realm. We have good food every day. We live in a peaceful place, a beautiful place. We have plenty of time every day, free time. Don't have to work all day. Hong En, can you please turn your camera off? The beeping's getting very annoying. Thank you. And so we stay here in this realm, which is like the deva realm. From the perspective of many people, even though from the average Australian point of view, maybe we live quite simply. But for many people in the world, just to have a full belly every day and to have a clean place to sleep and to not have to kind of work doing grinding manual labor all day, every day. That's already the heaven realm. Of course, other people would think we're living in the hell realms. Yeah? No fun, no games, no sex, no entertainment. So for some people, being at Santi would be very hellish, and they couldn't stand it even for a short time. So according to Buddhism and what the Buddha taught, all of these external things, different realms of existence, or indeed the different ways that people live in the visible realm, in the human realm, these are all things that are created by the mind. It's the mind that makes all of these different dwellings, these different places, these different ways that consciousness can manifest. You think about that. Put yourself now in the shoes of all different people in the world. And think what it's like to be a iron ore miner in the Kimberleys. What it's like to be a single mum struggling to get by in the western suburbs of Sydney. What it's like to be a fisherman in the Philippines. What it's like to be a Native American boy, 8 years old, living on a reservation in the desert. What it's like to be CEO of a big company. Even within the human realm, there's so much variation, so many different ways that people live their lives. All of these produced by the mind. So in Buddhist cosmology, when we're thinking about the way that the universe is, that we need to expand our minds, expand our vision. Because our notions of what's possible are merely conditioned from what we happen to have experienced in our lives. We've seen people living in various kinds of ways, and so we understand this. But our understanding, our experience is limited. We've only seen certain kinds of things. Other kinds of things are hidden. There is much in this world that we don't understand. Even according to physics, it seems that the bulk of the matter in the universe, the mass in the universe, is what they call dark matter. Most of it, most of what is in the universe is dark matter, and we hardly even know really whether dark matter exists, or if it does exist, what it's like. So it's not that dark matter is any more mysterious than ordinary matter. It's just that it's unknown. We just don't know what it is. That's all. And it's the same thing with consciousness. That we have a certain experience of the range of different types of consciousness and the different types of lives that it's possible to live. But that's only a small fraction. Our imagination can only take in a tiny fraction of the possibilities. You know, in convention, popular Buddhism, they often have these sort of cosmologies, and this kind of like a ladder of the different realms of existence and the different kinds of heavens and so on. And it all seems very neatly organized. You know, somebody's come along and got all of these categories and sort of fit everybody into a category, a bit like, I don't know, a bit like at a school or something like that, where you have a class, everybody's assigned to a class and you know where everyone goes. It's all very neat. You're in class A, you're in class B, you're in class C. It's easy. Because in the real world, things are much more complex, much more nuanced. And we recognize that in the real world, when we divide people up into groups and so on, that's only conventional. And it's only provisional. It only applies in a certain context for a certain period of time. And I think the same applies in the different Buddhist cosmology. I think that the way of dividing things, beings up into these different categories is somewhat fluid. It's open-ended. And in fact, if you look at the Buddhist scriptures, the Buddhist suttas, they mention dozens of different kinds of beings of one sort or another that don't obviously or easily fit into the conventional cosmology. They're just kind of politely passed over. So I like this idea of the open-endedness of things. That we can make our... we can try to define things, try to pin them down, but somehow it always eludes us. There's always something else, something left over, something extra. Because to me this is also one of the characteristics of life, of consciousness, of what it means to be alive, is that we have the things in our life, you know, that somehow take up a certain amount of space. You know, you have the material things, the possessions, they take up a certain space in your mind. You have your friends, family, loved ones, or the different relationships and connections, and you know that takes up another sort of area of your life. And you have kind of ideas and views and thoughts and likes and dislikes, all of these different aspects of what we consider to be life, the skills that we have, the learning and knowledge that we have, all of these things. But if we were to sit there and make a list, we could write all day, couldn't we? And yet there'd always be something left over. There's always something that we can't reduce life down to. I guess that this is what they call the soul, isn't it? It's that irreducible thing. It's that thing that we can't quite put our finger onto. And even though we don't kind of like using the word soul, see, the problem with using the word soul is that it tries to make a thing out of this irreducibleness, out of this leftovers. Say so, the remainder. And I think even though I prefer not to use that language of the soul, I think that the meaning of that idea still applies very much in the case of Buddhism. In the sense that the Dhamma, you know, the practice that we do, it has a quality that fills those empty places. It fills the gaps between all the other things in our life. It's not just one more thing. It's not just another hobby, another interest, another skill. It's not just another book to put on the shelf. But Dhamma is something which informs our life, gives a context, gives a meaning to our life in a way that nothing else can. And when we have Dhamma in our life, we're not trying to make everything perfect anymore. We're not trying to live in the Deva realm. We're not trying to have the perfect car or the perfect wife or the perfect hairdo. You know, trying to define ourselves by externals. Accessories. But when we have the Dhamma, we're quite content and quite happy with whatever happens, whatever the world throws at us. So that anywhere we are in that vast, varied, changing cosmology, that universe. If we're maybe happy, we feel like a deva or a god. Or we feel sad and depressed, lonely, like the ghost at the roadside. Doesn't matter how we feel. Doesn't matter what we're doing, who we're with. And somehow there's a center there. Somehow there's a there's something filled inside us. Something that makes us feel whole. Something that makes us feel that we are complete and content to be who we are. That we don't have to compare ourselves, judge ourselves by others, by this, by what we imagine others think of us. And nor do we have to go around judging and comparing other people, because of course that's just another projection of our insecurities, isn't it? It's the difference between judging others and having compassion for others. And having compassion, you put yourself in that other person's shoes. What is it like to be that person? What is it like to have the experiences that that person has had? And today we had a visit by this Vietnamese calligrapher, and he, I just learnt a little bit about him today, but like so many of the Vietnamese people that we see, he's suffered an incredible amount. He's in the jail in Vietnam for many, many years, and he's lost his sight in one eye, and is only 20% vision in the other, because of the trauma, the torture, the suffering that he experienced there. I've never experienced anything like that in my life. But I can try to reach out and try to imagine what that's like. Remember that in the whole round of samsara that we've lived, so many lives, hundreds of lives, thousands, millions of lives that we've lived, we've all been there. We've all been in jail. We've been tortured. We've been the torturer. We've all been raped. We've been the rapists. We've been murdered, we've been the murderer. Every situation, everything you look at, every kind of person that you can see, you look in the newspaper or something like that, and you see photos of people so far away on the other side of the world, crowds in the streets of Cairo protesting the government. You've been there. We've all been there. Everyone, every situation, we've been there. And when we think like that, we put our mind, try to broaden our mind, broaden our possibilities, broaden our conception of what it means to be conscious, of what it means to be alive. And as we do that, our minds become infinitely more malleable, more open, more receptive to wisdom. And remember that what we can see is only a small fraction. This is why the Buddha did did the recollection of past lives for such a long period. And he could see actually being born in all of these different places, experiencing all of these different kinds of joys, the delights, the boredom, the suffering, pain, grief, everything. And that's that whole realm of samsara. And in that whole realm, how many countless beings there are. You think about it, on our world we have, I think, 7 billion people, humans now on our planet. Not to mention all of the animals and all the unseen beings. And this is just one star. Think of all the other stars in the galaxy, in the universe. Countless billions of them. And according to Buddhism, there may well be life on many, many, many of these systems. Consciousness. And all of them, in some way, like that lonely ghost by the roadside, just waiting by the cross, the sign of mortality, forgotten. Nobody knows that they're there. They just watch the cars coming and cars going. The sun comes up. Sun goes down. One day it's raining, one day it's clear. The summer and the winter comes and goes. The cars keep going back and forth on the road. And you just stay there because, well, where else is there? Where do you go? This is what samsara is like. Where do we go? In the Atadanda Sutta, the Buddha talked about his experience before he went forth. I find this one of the most intriguing little suttas in the whole Pali Canon. Only a few verses. And even though we've heard the story of the Buddha's going forth so many times, and this very kind of artificial tale of being kept in the palace by his father and then going out and seeing the four signs, it's a very beautiful myth, but it's not at all realistic. It's a myth. But this story in the Atadanda Sutta is not a myth. It's the Buddha actually giving the reasons why. And this was what he said. He said that he looked everywhere, he looked in every direction. Everything was being tossed around. And he couldn't see a place of safety or security anywhere, in any direction. So this is it, this is samsara. And this is our life here, like lonely ghosts, waiting by the roadside. You know, if we think about it from the point of view of samsara, you know, we think that, for example, a lot of people think that they find meaning in their life through relationships, through, you know, getting married and making a family and so on. And of course, relatively speaking, that's true, they do. But that's just like the ghost is waiting by the roadside, who sees a car coming. He has a relationship with the car, and then the car disappears. That's it. From the point of view of samsara, that's how long a marriage and a family lasts. Comes, it's there for a second, it goes, that's it. If we look at it from the long perspective, that's what these things are. So this is our choice. Are we going to live our life like a lonely ghost or a hungry ghost who's always wanting, always relentlessly looking, thirsting for something else, thirsting to be somewhere where everything will be okay, where they'll get what they want, where they'll be with the person that they love, where they'll have the things that will make them happy? Are we going to live our life always thirsting for that? Or are we going to live our life with the Dhamma? With that Dhamma which tells us to be content. A Dhamma that tells us that here is perfectly good. Now is as good as it gets. This is what life is. Not something else, not something over there. Just this much is what life is. So if we live our life with bearing this in mind all of the time, in one way everything stays the same. But on another sense, everything becomes completely different. We have a sense of independence, a sense of confidence, a sense of ease. Whatever life throws at us, we're ready for it. And that sense of hollowness, that yearning, that sense of confusion, of not knowing what we're here for, what we're doing. That's just not there anymore. It just stops. And we know that we're here for this. I'm living my life for this moment. My journey ends here. Because this is the most wonderful place in the universe. And this, for me, is exactly where I need to be. These people are exactly the people I need to be with. And what I'm doing now is exactly the thing that I need to be doing. So this is my little talk for you this evening on lonely ghosts. And I offer this for your reflection. I'd like to invite if there's any comments or questions.
Okay. I feel very sorry for the ghost. I've got a picture of the ghost. But from what you were saying, it seems like there was really no difference between the ghost and the neighbor.
Not much, yeah.
We were talking about that, but, you know, just the diversity of human experience and life and people, you know, all the places around the world. Different, you know, it's quite mind-boggling, the hugeness, the vastness, the universe, etc., in different levels of existence. But what's the point of actually contemplating that with a mundane mind? I mean, you can sort of know it on an intellectual level, but you can't really know it until you've, you know, reached this stage of being able to recall past lives, and, you know, until you have some sort of higher attainment. So, you know, what's the point of actually, you know, even thinking about it, or trying to imagine yourself the same as, you know, the CEO of BHP, or, you know, a child in Africa or whatever. I mean, you could just go on forever if you started on that train of thought. Why?
Well, you could, and that's what they call samsara. Yeah,
yeah, but that was, isn't that, aren't we trying to stop doing that?
You're trying to stop it by understanding it.
Yeah, but how far do you have to go to understand it? Do you have to have knowledge of every single different possibility, or just sort of say, where's the going? That's what I'm saying. Once you start, there's a.
Until it's enough.
Pardon?
Until it's enough.
Well, when do you know it's enough?
When you let go.
Another question. Shanti at the beginning. What does that mean in English?
Mm-hmm. It's the last verse of the Suttanipata. It means the invincible, the unshakable, that to which there is nothing, there is no compare. For sure, I will go there. I have no doubt of that. You can remember me as one whose mind is made up.